In the past 3 years, $2.7 trillion has been wiped off the value of pension funds around the globe. Even before stock markets started falling, economists were warning that almost all of Western Europe's governments would be bankrupt by around 2020 if they tried to keep their pension promises to their citizens. I'm Vicky Barker. Over the next half hour, I'll be looking at a global crisis felt locally virtually everywhere on Earth. I'll take you to the world's richest economies, where dwindling stock portfolios, aging populations, and economic slowdown are threatening what we in the developed world once took for granted: a secure old age funded by our employers, our savings, or our governments. And we'll meet people living in the world's poorest economies, where planning for old age security still means having as many children as possible. And I'll ask the experts, are those people onto something? Our journey begins in my home country, the world's biggest economy, America. Maestro, please. Our star-spangled pension system has been held up as the model for the rest of the world. It's simple, really. Make individual citizens responsible for much, if not most, of their own retirement savings. That will spur them to invest their money as vigorously as possible, and that's good for the markets. And what's good for the markets is good for America. And what's good for America is good for us Americans. It's capitalism at its best. That was the idea, anyway. In reality, the bursting of the dot-com bubble has created winners and losers within individual families, including my own.
Stock goes up 2 or 3 points. That's effectively...
I own some of that one.
Clearly, it's
and
like
it went right down to two.
That's my father, Jim Barker. Nearly half of all U.S. households have part or all of their retirement savings tied up in the U.S. stock market before stocks began to tumble. But despite his gloomy tone, my 79-year-old father actually managed to surf the crest of the boom.
In the early 90s, 91, 92, I instructed Vanguard Mutual Funds to liquidate my holdings over a 15-year period so that by the time I was 85, I would have zilch, nothing left in my investment. Actually, at the end of like 12 years, I had more left in my portfolio than when I started.
My mother, 72-year-old Ruth Barker, got burned by the bust. Early on, she took a fancy to one of the more meteoric of the dot-coms. For about 18 dizzying months, she was a multimillionaire. On paper, anyway.
Any time that the stock went to 40 or below, I'd buy some. For a long time, it really worked well.
And how much is that stock worth now?
A lot less. So maybe there was a little hitch between the buying and the selling.
So, Dad, what's your advice to those of us baby boomer pit ponies who are trying to invest so that they can afford to retire someday? What investment advice do you have for us?
I have to be facetious and say invest 15 years ago.
Gee, thanks, Dad. I'm looking at two documents. The first one is my annual statement from the U.S. government's retirement savings program, Social Security. It's telling me that if I choose to retire at the age of 62, my monthly payout will be about $400 a month. That is well below the poverty line. Now, if I choose to or am able to work until I'm 70, then that payout will be more like $750 a month. Still not enough to live on. But as just about every working-age American knows, 2014 is the year that Social Security is expected to begin paying out more than it's taking in. And sure enough, in my statement, it tells me that if I live into my 80s, my monthly payout is expected to probably only be about 2/3 of my starting rate. Now, the other document is my monthly statement from my retail broker. And it is telling me that my retirement portfolio is now worth about 1/3 of what it was 2 years ago. But I am one of the lucky ones, because beneath the total, there is another line entitled minus margin loan outstanding. Now, in my case, that amount is zero. But millions of Americans were buying stocks with borrowed money, certain that stock prices only went up, not down. At the Sarasota News and Bookstore Cafe in the Florida resort of Sarasota, the music ranges from Mozart to merengue. But during the daytime hours, the TV is almost always tuned to one of the financial channels. Stock prices crawl across the bottom of the silent screen. The newscasters' mouths work like expensive tropical fish. This is the sort of place where members of my own generation, the baby boomers, hang out. Many of the 79 million Americans born between 1945 and 1965 bet their future on the stock market. The fall in stock prices has forced some to postpone or even cancel plans to retire. As many as half, though, never even had retirement savings, and they're realizing only too late that Social Security was never meant to support them in their old age.
The stockbroker convinced me, she said, you're going to have to take some risk in order to ever be able to retire. So I took a big chunk of savings and transferred it over to the stock market. And as a result now, I've lost about 25% of its value. And now I've got all this additional catching up to do just to get back to square one.
So how is this affecting your plans to retire?
It's pushed out my retirement now. We were originally thinking about age 70. Now we're somewhere into the 70s.
Well, I am very worried because I have no plan. My husband and I, we have two children, and we have no plans for retirement.
When you say no plans, you're not talking about we haven't made plans to buy that villa in the south of France with the two speedboats out it. You're talking about no retirement savings?
Exactly, yeah.
Nervous American baby boomers surveying a future which suddenly isn't as secure as they thought it would be. Tom Sertner is Director of Federal Affairs for the AARP, an organization which lobbies on behalf of older Americans. I asked him if Americans are having second thoughts about reforms which effectively abolished a guaranteed pension. Reforms which transferred all of the risk and responsibility for retirement savings from employer to employee.
It's a very good question. I think we're not really sure yet. Obviously, many people were concerned about the possibility of this, but given the markets always went up, it never became a reality. Now that it's a reality and beginning to seep into many people who've had these plans, I think we're just starting to see a lot of nervousness, a lot of economic nervousness out there. How this is going to translate is very difficult to say right now.
This is the world's largest economy. What lessons can America teach the rest of the world about pensions? What has America learned that the rest of the world might want to pay attention to?
I'm not sure if America has learned all these lessons yet, but here's some of the lessons I think that should have been learned. Don't rely on any one system. You want to have a number of systems, a government system supplemented by an individual system supplemented by an employer-provided system. That is probably the key lesson. And then that within some of these systems to make sure that if you're, for example, doing personal investing, that you have even your assets there adequately diversified. So a diversified system and then diversified investments within each of those systems. And that way you can weather these big ups and downs, and so that over the long term, it will be a much more adequate and secure retirement.
I wonder if there's a lesson that Americans have been learning for themselves. I'm an American myself, and I sometimes feel that we Americans feel that it is our God-given right to live forever and to get rich quick. And maybe some of these myths need to be reexamined.
Well, there's the old story about if there's no free lunch or if it looks too good to be true, then it probably is. That's probably the case with people who are expecting these sort of high returns from some of their individual account arrangements. It just wasn't going to continue, and in fact, obviously, that bubble has burst.
What a shame that the bubble burst after so many other countries had already taken the U.S. model as their template for pension reform. The American experience shows us what can happen when something as important as old age security is left to the mercy of market forces. But the European experience has shown that a more socialist approach, making government responsible for supporting you in your old age, is running out of steam, or more accurately, out of money. Earlier, I told you almost all of Western Europe's governments will face bankruptcy in the next 10 to 20 years if they don't do something drastic about their pension systems. To find out why this is so, let's turn now to the world's second biggest economy, Japan. An old people's home in the northern town of Fukushima. Low immigration and falling birth rates have left Japan the most rapidly aging nation on Earth. Close to 20% of the population is now over 65. By the year 2020, economists predict there will be only 1.5 workers per pensioner. A prescription for crippling tax burdens and potentially social calamity, or both. Listen to 64-year-old Keiko Ogaku.
I'm on a pension, but it's not really enough to live on without worrying. I think things will be even worse for today's youngsters when they retire. We may feel insecure, but it'll be worse for them.
A generation behind Keiko Ogaku is Kiyoshi Seto, 40-something, and already facing bleak economic prospects.
I'm worried about my pension. I'm in my late 40s, and I can see that I'll get much less than my father's getting now. I do worry about retirement. I'm not happy about the proposal to raise pension contributions, but I understand it'll probably be inevitable, given the current financial situation.
And a generation below that, listen to Mariko Nimi, in her 20s, and already worried about her old age.
I am paying a lot to contribute to my pension scheme, and I am concerned about the future. The newspapers say that nothing is certain, so we'll have to save by ourselves. I hear they're discussing increasing the consumption taxes, but that will be bad for shopping. It's all right if they raise tax on drink and cigarettes, because they're not essential.
But Japan is not alone. It's merely a melancholy trailblazer for global malaise. The fact of the matter is, if you live just about anywhere in the developed world, well, welcome to your future.
Well, actually, the aging of the population is a problem faced by practically all of our member countries, that's to say all OECD countries.
That's Monica Kweiser, an expert on aging and pensions for the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, a grouping of 30 of the world's industrialized democracies.
There are some differences in the urgency with which this problem is occurring in the different member countries. Some countries, and particularly in continental Europe, the problem is much more pronounced and much more urgent for a solution. There are other of our member countries where the populations are still younger and the aging problem will occur a little bit later.
Name some names for me.
The United States, for example, will encounter the problem substantially later than the continental European countries, whereas countries like Germany or Italy will be in trouble much earlier.
What's the situation in the rest of Asia? We heard about the situation in Japan.
In China, obviously, you're going to have a huge problem, which is a result of the one-child policy, which has been in function for so many years. So there will be very few young children, young people, workers, to support a huge amount of older people. There are other Asian countries, such as the Philippines, Malaysia, where fertility rates are still much higher and where the pensions problem is going to be substantially lower. But this does not mean that the pensions problem is in existence, because many of these countries have put in place pension systems which are much too generous compared to the financial capacity of the countries.
In other words, they're making promises to their workers that they cannot keep.
They are likely to have problems keeping these promises.
Can technology bail us out here? I mean, if technological advances increase a society's productivity, say, will it then become feasible for smaller workforces to support bigger populations of pensioners?
Certainly productivity increases would help, but the productivity increases necessary to compensate for population aging would have to be very, very large. Mm-hmm. And according to OECD projections, they would not be sufficient to compensate fully for the problem.
What about immigration? Can rich nations, for instance, buy in in a bigger workforce.
Again, immigration is giving us a very disappointing result. We've done calculations to see how much immigration would be necessary, again, to compensate aging of the population in OECD countries. And it turns out the numbers would have to be exorbitantly high.
You are painting a very daunting picture of what's in store, seemingly, for most of the developed world. When you look ahead 10, 20, 30 years, are you frightened?
A little bit, yes. I would say I'm a little bit frightened. I think we will all have to work much, much longer. But I think partly the problem will also be taking care of itself, because when there are no longer younger workers around, or not enough younger workers around, I believe that wages will rise, demand will rise, and almost automatically we will have a much more extended work life.
Monica Kweisser of the OECD in Paris. Well, as daunting as the pension picture painted so far may seem, please note that so far we've been looking at the rich countries, the heavyweights of global capitalism. Spare a thought now for the people, particularly the old people, of the former Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. I met Anna at Resurrection Gate, just outside Red Square.
Я из Москвы. Зовут меня Анна. Русское имя Анна. Переведите.
I'm from Moscow and my name is Anna. This is a real Russian name, Anna. I'm 77 and I'll soon be 78. For 45 years I worked as a nurse in Hospital 13. 45 years. And now I'm a cleaning lady, because I have a husband in the hospital without both legs. He's been in the hospital now 2 years. I'm not ashamed of what I do because I need to pay the doctors. I have to bribe the staff to change his dressings, give him his injections. The pension is not enough. All I get goes to the hospital. I get 2,000 rubles, about $65, and it's not enough. In the Soviet times, I had a pension of 132 rubles, but it was plenty. You see the clothes I'm wearing, they're all from the Soviet Union times. I haven't bought a single thing since perestroika, not even a headscarf. I didn't eat anything yesterday. I haven't had anything to eat today either.
There are millions of Annas scattered across the former communist world, people who had the bad luck to be old when the new economic order dawned. Mario Nuti is an economist at the University of Rome and a visiting professor at the London Business School.
I think in Russia, the life expectancy for a male fell from 64 to 57 during the first years of transition. The condition of old age pensioners in Russia was summarized by saying that in Russia, there is a pay-as-you-go system. First you pay and then you go. Of course, things now have improved greatly.
It sounds as if the people living in the communist countries got a crash course in capitalism.
Oh yes, very much so. In fact, for many it's been a case of instant capitalism. But of course, with the greater expectation of growth, there's also been greater unemployment, greater poverty, greater inequality, which of course other side of the prevailing capitalist model.
So you have people wishing they could turn the clock back. Can the clock be turned back?
Well, what we can go back to is some kind of government guarantee or some minimum pension, but there is no way back to the old system, which was certainly doomed. I mean, we can argue whether had the reform taken a different path, maybe some of its features might have been preserved. But certainly there is no going back.
Mario Nuti of the London Business School warning us against any nostalgia for the economic certainties that communism promised, but ultimately failed to deliver. When it comes to pension security, we have all been expelled from the workers' paradise. But what of the roughly one-half to two-thirds of the people on this planet who go from birth to death never expecting a pension check? They don't show up in marketing surveys and opinion polls. Their voices are rarely, if ever, heard. They belong to the invisible economy, also known as the peasant or informal economy. Let's hear some of their thoughts about their old age. First, Evair Silva, a street seller and an illegal internal immigrant in Sao Paulo, Brazil, whose livelihood depends on the simple cart from which he sells his produce.
I work selling coconuts. I work for 12 hours a day, sometimes more in the summer. But I only just survive doing this. I don't earn much. I'm from Bahia. I came to São Paulo to find work. I don't know how I'm going to do when I'm old. I will have to think. I have only this cart and faith in God. I have no money. I'm 34. I would like to retire one day, but if I don't have a pension, how am I going to live after I'm 40? Because you know that after 40 in Brazil, no one will give you work.
Exatamente, é Deus. É Deus sabe preparar todos nós. Só ter fé nele.
Evair Silva in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Half a world away from Brazil, a generator roars in a market in Johannesburg, South Africa, where Bridget Mkosi has her store.
I am 60 years old. I have a little shop here in Johannesburg. It hasn't shown up any signs of success, but it's getting there. I'm worried a little bit because I'm growing old and haven't seen the light in the tunnel yet. And I'm not even ready to retire because I haven't got anything for my future, for my little girl. I have a girl who is not even employed. And then I have boys. They're helping me, but I'm not happy about the whole setup because they have their families to take care of.
Evair and Bridget will never retire in the sense that people in the wealthy world would understand. But as desperate as their plight may seem, Theodor Shannon says they are unlikely to die of hunger. Shannon is the Moscow sociologist credited with developing the study of the informal economy. He describes a world defined not by written contracts or paychecks or pension checks, but by the invisible bonds of familial duty and, dare we say it, of love.
Informal economy is many things, and there's no way to define it by a single sentence, because whichever sentence you choose, it will be incorrect on its own. But I believe that the most significant aspect of that is that it is a family economy, and an economy which is not based on contact, formalized contact. It is something which is based on understandings, on mutual relationship, on trust based in personal relations.
Professor Shannon, this might be taking you out of the specific area of your field, but I wonder if I could ask you, who then is the worse off? The old lady living in some house with a dirt floor somewhere in the third world, who is being taken care of by her extremely poor but existing family, or the middle-class pensioner who is getting a check every month but perhaps has no family network to support him or her?
The pensioner with a check has the security of continuous obligation of formal nature. In this sense, his or her situation is better. But in terms of human relationship, which are so important, as the age moves on, it is the informal economy, the family economy, which often provides more human environment and more agreeable old age and end of life.
Sociologist Theodor Shannon on the peasant or informal economy, where old age security isn't necessarily measured by bank balances. In the course of my research, I haven't found a single society, rich or poor, where there isn't deep fear about old age security. Richard Ramsden is an economist with Goldman Sachs in London and a world expert on pension programs. I asked him if any country has managed to cure its pension problem.
I don't think anybody has cured the pension problem. I would say that there are different countries are at different stages of development. There's no question that the United States is a long way ahead in terms of developing a private pension scheme. And I would say within Europe, the UK is perhaps 15 years ahead of most of continental Europe. But it's clear, even looking at the United States and the UK, there does have to be a great deal more private funding of pensions, and state benefits need to come down further from the low levels that they are today.
We've been talking about this issue as if it were an abstraction, but of course we're talking about our own futures, and I want to ask you, are you worried about your old age security?
Well, I asked my 6-year-old daughter the other day if she was going to pay for my pension, and she said no, and that to me was conclusive evidence that I was going to have to save a lot more for my retirement. Yes, it is something which I have certainly started to think about a great deal more as we've done the research on the pension situation and what you can expect.
Richard Ramsden of Goldman Sachs. It's funny, right up until the moment the dot-com bubble turned to rubble, Wall Street wizards and even some economists were saying the boom might never end. It was a new economy, a new paradigm, they said. But perhaps the global pension crisis is the real new paradigm. I grew up in an America which considered capitalism, freedom, and democracy almost interchangeable terms. Even the most conservative Americans, the people who saw social welfare programs as a communist plot, never questioned that their country or their company would take care of them in their old age. Americans and their cousins all across the developed world are only slowly realizing that changing demographics and a more globalized economy are threatening what they once considered a birthright. So is this pension crisis a crisis of confidence in capitalism itself? A question I put to the economist Lord Desai of the London School of Economics.
It's not a crisis of confidence. It's a crisis of expectations. We've got to get people used to the fact that the state will not provide. Absolutely. And the state has to have the courage. Politicians have to have the courage to say, don't look at us. You provide for yourself somehow or other, bargaining with your employer, saving yourself or whatever. But you can't go on expecting the pensions that your fathers and grandfathers had.
This is quite striking coming from you, Lord Desai, because if I understand correctly, you in your own lifetime have made a bit of a personal odyssey from Marxism to capitalism.
Well, I mean, I still call myself a Marxist because basically you have to understand capitalism, and only a Marxist understand capitalism.
Your adversary is that.
Yeah, basically it's global capitalism is very different from what we were all used to. Unfortunately, that message hasn't sunk in, and our politics are carried on as if the individual nation state is going to look after its citizens. And it is not going to be. I mean, that whole game is over. And we just haven't got the politicians to be able to boldly say, look, rethink.
The economist Lord Desai of the London School of Economics. There are no quick or easy answers to the global pension crisis. There are only a few crooked signposts pointing towards an uncertain future. If we're working age now, we should expect to work longer than our parents before us, and we'll have to invest and save aggressively for our old age now that our governments and our employers are no longer doing it for us. But I wonder, how many of us may find that our old age security will ultimately depend on a different kind of investment? As the sociologist Theodor Shannon said, and as economist Richard Ramsden just suggested, ultimately, a comfortable old age may hang on how we have loved our children and how our children love us.